It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
That seems to me like government is establishing a religion.
The latest in politics and world affairs.
If you give people rights, women's rights, gay rights, whatever, there can't be equal rights if there's special rights.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
Surveys show that people still really prefer freedom versus force.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Indeed. Let's have a conversation. Welcome to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Happy Tuesday. And back behind the boards is producer Steve. You're feeling better. You had a little diet this weekend, huh? A little flu diet.
Now, let's just say it was one of those that first you're afraid you'll die, and then later you're afraid you won't.
I'm sorry, but I'm glad that you're feeling better.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here back in the chair. And you know, I was just thinking, I wouldn't wish that on anybody. And I thought, even Adam Schiff, I thought, well, let me think about that.
Oh, Steve, you're back. And thanks to Tracy. She jumped in at the last minute and she did a great job. But it's great to have you back as well, Steve.
Thank you.
And we have a very good show again planned for you today. We'll go through some of these issues and headlines that are out there. And then in the third and fourth segment, we'll be talking with Dr. Brian Dmitrovic, and he is a historical economist. He'd written the book with Larry Kudlow, JFK and the Reagan Revolution, The Secret to American Prosperity. And he's written a really interesting piece. It was just published on the 24th of January in Forbes magazine. It says, the Federal Reserve should be open to closing. And that's going to be very fascinating. I know a lot of people have a lot of thoughts about the Fed. We'll have to get Jay Davidson on and ask him about that as well. So that will be in the third and fourth segment. And as always, thank you to you, the team. You guys are all treasured. You're valued. Steve, Zach, Patty, Keith, and Charlie. And thank you to each of you listeners out there as well. You're each treasured. You're valued. You have a purpose. So go out there and do that today. And strive for, strive for excellence as you interact with people and be kind. Always be kind. So want to get into this. It looks to me like I've got to get the outline up here on the, because I think that I'm missing a page here. And I had this great joke. So I'm going to see if I can get to that, Steve. Let's see if it's
great,
on here.
Great joke. Really?
It's.
Okay.
Okay. So let's see if I can get to that here. Hold on just a second. I had all this great stuff. And okay, here we go. Okay, inspiration, wisdom. That's going to be the first thing we're going to do. It's from JFK, his inaugural address in 1961. John Fitzgerald Kennedy was an American politician who served as the 35th president of the United States from January 1961 until his assassination in November of 1963. He served at the height of the Cold War, and the majority of his work as president concerned relations with the Soviet Union and Cuba. A Democrat, Kennedy represented Massachusetts in the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate prior to becoming president. And just a note, Steve, the Democrat Party of today is not the Democrat Party of JFK. JFK lowered taxes. He believed that government should be limited. And so this is no longer his party. So when people want to vote party line, you might want to check your premises on this.
Okay. Yeah, if they say they're a JFK Democrat, that's quite a delineation.
It really is. And
although I hate to bring this up, I hit you blindside, but just yesterday, obviously, I was flat on my back and desperate for something to entertain the brain with. Re-looking, watching for a second time Ken Burns' documentary on Vietnam.
Oh.
And there was a quote in there about Kennedy kind of just trading thoughts with one of his close advisors. And I probably shouldn't even brought this up without being able to quote it directly. But he says, well, here's the problem. And if I don't do this, I will upset the country enough and I won't get reelected.
Ooh.
And it just hit me like a brick. It's like, so you're saying that keeping these people, these advisors at that point, because this was 62, I believe, keeping these advisors of Vietnam, and there were already American deaths on the things that were going on. So that was the important, a good enough reason to keep them there in harm's way so that you would get reelected.
Yeah.
And it, like I say, it hit me like a brick.
He's not the only one. He is not the only
one.
Oh,
no.
Washington is full of those kinds of politicians right now. And so let's, but this is a great quote, okay? Let's go to this. This was 1961. He said, "In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it, and the glow from that fire can truly light the world." I think that we're in such a time as this right now, Steve, but he goes on to say, "And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. And my fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man." Those are pretty beautiful words, Steve.
You know, mostly we always hear that the little excerpt from there is like, don't ask what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. But the full context, like you, that you just read, is incredibly powerful.
It is. It really is. And so I thought I wanted to share that with all of you today. And our joke for today, our...
I saw this, and I'm cringing already.
Okay. I've got to get to it. I'm all over the place here on this outline because one page didn't print off, Steve. So, you know, normally I like all that paper. So hold on here. Okay. Ready? Here we go. A grasshopper sits down at a bar, and the bartender says, "We have a drink named after you." And the grasshopper asks, "You have a drink named Steve?"
Okay, I got to tell you that the drummer's sitting here shaking his head from side to side. He's...
When I saw that, I just had to use that, though. So, okay, and you know, as we look at these issues, we look at these issues as freedom versus force, force versus freedom, and that's not funny. It's pretty darn serious. And had talked with Patty, and she does all of our research. She said, "How about, Kim, let's highlight a bill a day." And so we're going to have one every day through this legislative session. The legislative session started on January 8th. It goes to the first part of May. But how's your blood pressure? Did you have any blood pressure issues with the flu?
No.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, last Thursday, and this is so weird, the Thursday was my annual physical, and my blood pressure was just perfect, picture perfect.
Really? Cool. Well, congratulations. Because after I tell you this, it's not going to be.
Okay.
This is Senate
Thank
Bill
you.
20. And so that would be SB 20, stands for Senate Bill, the year 20004. It's get on your feet student loan repayment assistance program. It's a student loan repayment assistance program for post-secondary education. This is being proposed right here in Colorado. And in the Senate, it's by Senator Finberg. And on the House, it's Representatives Herod and McCluskey. And first thing that Patty has noticed is they are proposing all kinds of things that are going to cost money, and there are no fiscal notes. And it seems to me like if you are going to propose something, you better have all your ducks in a row so that people can understand it. So there is no fiscal note attached to the bill. And it's going to be taxpayers' funds that will be distributed to a select group of interested parties. Key phrases within the bill include recipients of out-of-state degree holders are allowed to participate, and if extreme hardship is shown, the reimbursement can be extended beyond the stated 2 years. Other key phrases is the department, so that's the government, with your money, shall make monthly payments directly to the federal loan administrator on a qualified loan or on behalf of a qualified recipient. Says the recipient, get this, Steve, must be a resident of Colorado and have resided in Colorado for not less than the previous 12 continuous months unless the person is a military member. And they must have primary work location in Colorado unless the person is a military member. Did you get that, Steve? You can move here. You can live here, from what we can tell, for 12 months, and then you can have the people of Colorado start to pay off your first 2 years of college debt. How do you feel about that, Steve?
You know, we do this day in and day out, and after a while you get, it's like when you water your house plants, and if you pour the water on too fast, it doesn't absorb, it just kind of runs over. And I'm at that point with stuff like this. I can't get my head around how they come up with this kind of stuff and the rules. and you think, okay, what special interest here is being serviced, is being caressed? I don't know.
Well, I think it also goes to something that you mentioned, and that's vote buying. You know, if you can get people to move to Colorado to be beholden to the government for their student loans, it's, again, vote buying. And there's no fiscal note on it. My understanding is there wasn't enough money to pay for everything that they did last year. And so here we have this going on and no fiscal notes. It's absolutely unbelievable.
I'm not that smart of a guy. I don't see myself as being, you know, really on top of things. But maybe we ought to do a show one day just on that topic alone, vote buying. And I think I did do a little check several months ago when it first came on my radar, and it's like it's been with us all for a long time. There's really new about vote buying, but it's just the mentality behind the vote buyers as to why they do what they do and why this is the right thing to do in terms of their methodology.
Well, you know, instead of thinking about being representatives of the people and doing the things that government is supposed to be doing, now what you just mentioned, there was that quote that I'm doing this to get reelected. And you know what, Steve, we have to have a responsibility on us, the voters, as well. And at some point in time, as Maggie Thatcher said, the money will be gone. There's not enough. And then we become something like Venezuela, because there's never enough money that you can take from one person to give to another, because your people that produce will stop producing. And then ultimately there will be nothing to give. And so everybody will be equal. They will be equal in their misery. And then you'll have the elites that are still, doing quite well. But it's because that they haven't created anything. Their wealth has been created because they have taken it from other people. Let's go to break here. We'll talk about some more headlines. Before we do that, though, I can't believe it. The big game is right around the corner. The Chiefs and the Niners. Go Chiefs. The place to watch the big game is Hooters Restaurants. They have plenty of TVs, so you won't miss any of the action. And if you join them for the big game, you'll be entered for a chance to win a 55-inch HD TV. Try their new roasted wings while you watch the Avs and Nuggets chase a playoff spot. And Wednesday is Dine and Wing Day, all the wings you can eat for $15.99. And if you're having friends over and you don't want to cook, just have Hooters wings delivered right to your front door. For more information, go to my website, kimmunson.com, and take a look at all the sponsors there. I highly recommend all of them. I know them personally. And also, be sure and sign up for our newsletter, our email newsletter that goes out once a week. It'll keep you apprised of what is happening, all the great guests. Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll talk some more headlines.
You want to succeed, so you need to dress for the job, event, or relationship that you seek. For more than 30 years, entrepreneur and stylist Kim Munson has been helping women look their very best. And guys, Kim can help you with made-to-measure shirts that fit great and you'll love to wear. Guys and gals, if you want to up your game, freshen your look, email kim@kimmunson.com for your initial style consult. Kim@kimmunson, MONSON.com.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. I'm very concerned about Colorado. Yesterday we highlighted, or low-lighted, you might say, a piece that the news just came out that Russell Stover, who has a candy factory over in Montrose. Montrose is a beautiful area, is closing that factory, taking away 400 jobs in that community. That is going to make a big difference in Montrose. And they will be moving jobs to Kansas and to Texas. And I think that what we're starting to see is the effects of all of this bad policy that has been occurring down at the State House and in the governor's mansion here in Colorado. So very sad to say, we've got another announcement here from the Denver Business Journal, and that's Lucky's Market. They have filed for bankruptcy, and they're closing its corporate headquarters in Niwot. The Lucky's Market parent company, a registered LLC, owes about $36 million to its 30 largest creditors, and based on Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization petitions, the company and its affiliated stores filed last Monday. The company checked the box on the paperwork saying it had between 10,000 and 25,000 creditors. It says in addition to the parent company filing for the bankruptcy reorganization, A slew of affiliated companies also filed for Chapter 11, including individual stores and such as in Longmont, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Naples, Florida. So, Steve, what we have seen is where government has been picking winners and losers through corporate welfare. We highlighted that as we were looking at Proposition CC, where these PBIs were asking to keep our Tabor tax refunds forever because they say that there's not enough money. Then we highlighted almost $1.3 billion over a period of just a couple of weeks that the government of the state of Colorado had given to different corporations, picking winners and losers. And when that starts to happen, bad things start to happen. And we're starting to see some of these little businesses file Chapter 11. And this is going to start to make a big difference here in Colorado, Steve.
So you and I talk every morning when you're on your way in. So I know that you're up and around. And I think you basically said you highlighted both of these situations as we were talking and saying inadvertently, is this what's happening due to the raised cost of doing business?
Absolutely. It truly, truly is. Another headline that we have on here from the Center Square, it says Colorado ranks 17th best in new economic outlook analysis. I remember when we were in the top 10 and we are starting to drop. And I talk to more and more people that are thinking about their exit plans out of Colorado. If you're going to leave Colorado and you want to sell your house, you probably better call Karen Levine with RE/MAX Alliance because she knows the business. I really hope that's not going to happen here in Colorado. But Steve, the forced minimum wage that we've talked about, this Family Leave Act that forced paid family leave, this overtime rule that just came out. All these things are really going to squeeze your mom and pop businesses. Bigger corporations will have, more of an opportunity to be able to absorb that. But at some point in time, they probably won't either. Another one of our headlines, though, is we don't need to have government be forcing this paid family leave. But it looks like those that are trying to get this forced paid family leave passed. They're trying to get it through the legislature, but they've got a plan B, and that is it's to put pressure on the legislators that if in fact they don't do something about it, Colorado Families First, and that's a misnomer, filed two ballot initiative proposals with the state's legislative council on the 21st, where they could actually put that initiative on the ballot. So they're pulling out all stops to try to get this forced paid family leave in, and it is going to hurt employers. And I think you're going to see more employers leave, just like we saw with Russell Stover's, and you're going to see also employers file bankruptcy. Any comments, Steve?
It is what it is. The big picture just seems to escape so many in government itself. And how can you keep on piling on these additional costs to do business and expect businesses to just go on and shake it off? Sooner or later, there has to be a breaking point.
There will be a breaking point. And I think I don't know if they don't know or if they don't care. But after our Stand for Colorado rally, I was talking to one of our listeners, and he said that he went into the state house the Capitol because he just kind of wanted to see what's going on. And he said, interestingly enough, the legislators and their aides would not make eye contact. And that typically happens when you're not real proud of maybe something that you're doing, Steve. Okay, another thing on the headlines, this is from the Denver Business Journal, that that's not the place I wanted to go. I wanted to go with CenturyLink. Hold on, here we go. This is also from the Denver Business Journal, that CenturyLink is rolling out a new benefit for its full-time U.S. employees. And it's going to expand benefits to include child care, aging adult care, and even pet care, some of which will be subsidized by the company. It says the Monroe-based, Louisiana-based telecommunications giant is partnering with Care.com to offer extended care benefits to its full-time U.S. employees. And it's using a customized version of Care's business offering. And so the point on that is, Steve, is that businesses do not need to be forced to do this. They can make their own choice, and they can attract employees doing that. It makes it difficult maybe for your smaller businesses. Your big businesses could do that, but you don't need to have government forced to do that. Let people and their employers work it out together instead of government getting in the middle of it.
All right. This is not pushback. This is just an observation. I became a civilian employee technically in 1980, and benefits has always been, you know, on the in your mind somewhere in your work environment. But what are benefits? What companies are trying to be, I guess, competitive with each other, who can offer the best package? That's fine. But it becomes a competition, and after a while, it seems to get out of hand.
Well, once again, though, when government gets involved, that's where you start to have real problems. When you have businesses compete for workers, when you have a hot economy and businesses compete for workers, you're going to see different things that will be offered, whether or not it's more pay, perhaps it's this paid family leave. Government has no business in being in that. And so you need to keep government out of that. And that is one of the reasons. My understanding is that there were wage and price controls back in the, I want to say in the 60s. Government came in. I think they were concerned about inflation. So they start playing in with wage and price controls. And so companies started to offer health insurance as a benefit. And so you, as you mentioned, though, eventually that has gotten out of hand because the whole healthcare industry, the costs are so high. I was talking to a young millennial, and yes, they have health insurance, but it costs them $1,200 a month. Their deductible is $7,000 per family member with an $11,000 max, you know, for the family per year. Yeah, they have health insurance, but it's not affordable. And it's all because government has gotten involved with that. We've talked to Dr. Jill Vecchio, who read the whole complete Obamacare bill, and she said that rules and regulations account for at least 40% of the cost of health care. So if we want to get real serious about bringing health care costs down, then we need to have more transparency, and we need to get rid of a lot of these rules and regulations. Steve, any comments?
Well, I'm thinking of Jill's, the time that we've had her on the show, the times, and, you know, transparency. Some of the most fundamental things. Where do you go, you know, to a restaurant or some other place of consumer-minded businesses and look at some kind of a guide to what it costs? What's on the menu? How much are tires? Whatever.
Right. You're going to want to know how much it costs.
But try to walk into any healthcare facility and find out, well, name a procedure. Pick one.
Well, I will tell you, I was at one of my healthcare providers for something. I won't say what exactly. And I said, okay, how much does this cost? And they said, oh, don't worry. Insurance is taking care of it. I'm like, but how much does it cost?
Oh, and by the way, who's your healthcare provider? That way we know. You know.
Right.
So, because different healthcare providers will probably conjure up a different cost.
Right. And so I think that we could bring costs down. This young person I was talking to said, the Republicans need to figure something out about this because that is something that really matters to millennials, is these health care costs. And so we need to figure something out about that instead of just, oh, let the free market handle it. What is the plan? How can we actually bring these costs down? Because we can do it, and we need to make sure that we go to work on that. We want to talk transportation, Steve, and we continue to have these headlines on here, and we've missed one. Before we get to Jason McBride, we'll probably talk transportation again later in the week, but there was one that you had wanted to talk about, and that was there was this app that, in fact, it could be used to help people figure out how to carpool up to the mountains so that we could reduce congestion and have less cars on the road and make it more, you know, easier for people to get up to the mountains. And guess what? Let me see where that is. Here we go. This was from the Know at the Denver Post. It says, TreadShare, an app meant to provide a method of carpooling to the ski slopes from Denver, launched. The idea behind the app is for carpoolers to share the cost of gas and mileage, incentivizing the drivers to bring additional passengers and the passengers to get a cheap ride up to the mountains. Shortly following the launch, TreadShare received a cease and desist letter from the Colorado Public Utilities Commission. This caused TreadShare to shut down operations and another similar app, Gondola, not to launch. While both companies attempted to be sure that their apps did not fall under a transportation network company designation by making the apps a cost-sharing method rather than profit-making, The apps were designated transportation network companies under Colorado's revised statutes. It says the law defining a transportation network company effectively puts these carpooling apps into the same category as Uber and Lyft, meaning they would have to follow the same expensive licensing procedures, which are not feasible for such apps that prioritize cost savings. Can you believe that, Steve?
And the answer to that conundrum comes clearly in that last two or three sentences there. The high cost licensing and all that the state would not get.
There you go.
Can you any mystery behind that one?
Yeah. So when they wring their hands and say, oh, my gosh, we have to do something about congestion, they're not really serious about that, because here we had a solution and they shut them down because of licensing. On that, Jason McBride, Presidential Wealth Management, how are you doing this Tuesday morning?
I'm doing good. Hey, I hear they're going to start having private jet services at the ski areas for people that don't want to take the time to ride the lift to the top of the mountain.
I wonder how much that's going to cost, Jason.
Well, I'm sure. And it won't pollute much.
There you go. So, but hey, Jason, the last few days we've talked about the concept of buy low and sell high. That's a good idea, but it's not that easy to do, is it?
Well, it's not, Kim, and it's hard for several reasons. One, there's a term called relative deprivation, and that causes some problems. It means even though we may successfully buy low and sell high sometimes, and thus we get a positive outcome, we still agonize that we could have bought even lower, maybe sold even higher, if only our timing had just been perfect.
So in a way, we can be our own worst enemy.
Yeah, I think you're right, Kim. Another study showed that investors feel twice as much pain over a loss as the amount of pleasure they feel when they have a gain. But that can also be transferred to whether you feel like you did something right or wrong. So even when we do get it right and sell for a profit, we still end up kicking ourselves for not having that perfect timing. You know, we could have done better, so we still feel like we did it wrong.
No wonder if there's these stories of investors jumping out of windows. Even when you're right, you don't feel like you were right enough.
Yeah, that's right, Kim. Well, you were a stock trader in your previous life. I bet you felt some of this brain damage at one time or another, right?
Well, close. I was actually an assistant, but I saw it firsthand, these guys. I know exactly what you're talking about.
So I'm taking ulcer pills and heart pills and all that stuff, right?
All that stuff, absolutely.
Yeah, so, well, one of the things that's hard to get a handle on sometimes is there's a big difference between low and the bottom, or high and the top. And I've always said that only the liars get in exactly at the bottom and out exactly at the top.
For sure. Most of the time it feels like our timing's perfect at getting in right at the top and out at the bottom, though.
Yeah, well, you know, Kim, I've heard that a lot of times in my career, too. But, you know, really, it's seldom true. I think, again, you know what that is? It's that 2-to-1 ratio of pain to pleasure twist in our brain sometimes that we forget the successes and the ones that go wrong hurt worse. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, you have to remember that buying low and selling high, it doesn't mean you're going to be perfect. It doesn't mean you'll do everything exactly right. But if you can get a decent chunk of the middle of a move, I think that's pretty good.
You're probably right about that. So like the old song says, take it easy on yourself.
Yeah, that's right, Kim. You know, investing's hard. Think about this. If you buy right 70% of the time and you sell right 70% of the time, you have a 49% success rate overall. So if you're right half the time, you're doing pretty good. I still think the key is to try to keep your mistakes small. It's hard to sell and take a loss, but you know, I've noticed you forget about the small ones pretty quick, and you move on. It's the big ones that linger on and on and on until they finally wear you out and sell that end up being kind of mentally crippling to you.
Yeah, I've seen that. So you have a free report on all these things that we've discussed the last few days, and you can get a copy at airpresidential.com. That's airpresidential.com. Jason, I know it's a great report. And in the next segment, we're going to talk with Dr. Brian Dmytrovic about the Fed, and I know that's something that you're really interested in as well. And be sure and get this this report as well. So we're going to talk to Brian here in just a minute, Jason.
Okay, well, that sounds great. Well, you know what's interesting about the Fed is we haven't heard much from him lately, which is just the way it should be.
Well, actually, this is his title on his Forbes article. He says, the Federal Reserve should be open to closing. So I think it's going to be a fascinating conversation.
Well, I will stick around. Well, Kim, yep, you're right. Get your report, airpresidential.com. It's called From Zero to Hero. You could get it there or give Natalie a call at 730 at 303-694-1600. It's a fun read.
Great. Thanks so much, Jason. We'll talk to you tomorrow. We'll be right back with Dr. Brian Dmytrovic.
A reverse mortgage can be an important financial tool for individuals 62 and older. It is essential to understand the process so that all of your questions are answered. With over 17 years in the mortgage industry, Lauren Levy, Polygon Financial Group, has the experience to answer your questions. Lauren knows that each financial transaction is personal. If you'd like to explore your options on a reverse mortgage or with rates down, explore options to remodel your home, buy a rental property, or move, call Lauren Levy at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881 for a mortgage checkup.
You'd like to get in touch with one of Kim Munson's sponsors, but you can't recall their phone number. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim, MONSON.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out my website, Kim Munson. That's MONSON.com. And sign up for our email newsletter. Sign up there. On the line with me is Dr. Brian Dmytrovic. You know him. He has a PhD from Harvard. He is the author of Econoclast, The Rebels Who Sparked the Supply-Side Revolution and Restored American Prosperity. And he co-authored the book, JFK and the Reagan Revolution, A Secret History of American Prosperity, with Larry Kudlow. He is the Richard S. Strong Scholar at the Laffer Center and writes a regular column in Forbes magazine, Past and Present. And I met Brian when he was here in Colorado in Boulder as the visiting scholar of conservative thought and policy at CU. Dr. Brian Dmytrovic, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kim. It's really great to be here.
You just have written this piece in Forbes, The Federal Reserve Should Be Open to Closing. The Federal Reserve can evoke a ton of emotion with a lot of people. So this is a pretty important perspective that you are putting forth.
Yeah, you know, most businesses form because they see an opportunity in the marketplace. I just went to an event last week with Arthur Laffer, with the founders of a human resources company here in Houston called Insperity, which is now a New York Stock Exchange listed company. And they saw in the 1980s, for example, that everyone was doing HR in-house. And they said, well, we can outsource this, particularly through the nascent internet. So they saw an opportunity. They formed a company. The company has done very well. Now, we don't expect Insperity necessarily to last 117 years because the configuration of the economy in the next century will be very different, presenting very different opportunities. It is really quite unheard of for a business that forms to plan on existing literally forever over the centuries. So my question is, what is the Fed doing about recognizing that it was formed at a time that is no longer applicable today?
Well, and give us a little bit of history. It's 117 years old. It was formed during, I would say, almost kind of a progressive era in America. So give us a little history on the Fed.
Yeah, there's no question, Kim, that bankers, private bankers, really were the ones who created the Federal Reserve. There was a sense after a little stock market crash that ended up not really meaning anything in 1907, and in particular, after the United States itself, foolishly, for no good reason other than mismanagement, almost went bankrupt in 1893, that a couple bankers, including J.P. Morgan's people and Rockefeller's people, got together in Georgia and said, why don't we have a federal institution that can backstop all the banks? And that's just what those big bankers from that time wanted. Now, we have a completely different kind of banking configuration today. There's no reason that some solution these guys felt they needed in 1913 has any real relevance to us today in 2020.
Well, and Brian, I find it interesting that this happens in 1913, and then the Great Depression happens within, what, 10 or 15 years?
Well, Kim, there's really, that is the egg, and egg is not strong enough a word on the face of the Federal Reserve. So we always hear that we went through all these panics in the 19th century. Well, the mother of all panics that blew them all out of the water was after 1929. And that, of course, is when the Fed was a rookie, was the new kid on the block, as economics novelist and supply-sider Robert Mundell calls it. So, yes, isn't that interesting? As soon as the Fed decided to come about, we saw a financial panic and then an extended period of economic privation that was utterly without like in American history after, you know, when it wasn't even 20 years old.
Well, and so just explain, though, what was the perceived task that the Fed was supposed to do? Was it this backstop of banking, or what was that exactly?
Yes, that's really all it was. There was something called the clearinghouse system back then. It worked very well, by the way. So anytime there was a little crisis, and usually, by the way, the crises were occasioned by the government. If the government did something wrong, there was a crisis in the banking system, but the private sector had to bail out the government. And so that would lead to a lack of reserves in the banking system. They couldn't make all their deposits with all their loans out there. And so they tried to figure out how they could kind of share their reserves among all the banks so that they could weather a crisis. And that was actually done privately, again, through this thing called the clearinghouse system. And it's funny, though, I say the company shouldn't exist. One of the big clearinghouse companies from back then still exists today. It's called the Clearinghouse Company. Its lineage dates from the 19th century. So these bankers, the Rockefeller and Morgan people, said, why don't we just have a federal institution that does that? And, okay, if they wanted that, that's fine. But there's absolutely no reason, none at all, that we should say that the private sector can't do that itself.
You know, Brian, one of the things on learning from doing this show over so many years is that big government and big business like each other, because big business can use government to encourage for their purposes, or at least that's what I'm hearing, is you had big business guys that decided, hey, let's see if we can use government to kind of be this backstop. Am I deducing that correctly?
Yeah, I think you are. Now, I do also think in the case of these people who founded the Fed, there was buyer's remorse almost immediately, in that the Federal Reserve, even before the Great Depression, presided over a remarkable inflation that was not long out of the system. The price level doubled suddenly from 1913 to 1920, coincident with World War I, but then didn't recover its original level, as had always happened after wartime, after the Civil War, in the context of tremendous economic growth, and even after the War of 1812. So then that meant that, like, the J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller fortunes were cut in half because the price level had doubled. And they're like, what's going on here? And there was nothing like the destruction of fortunes that we saw in the 1930s. I mean, we talk about the little guy, having trouble eating in John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. Let's spare a thought for the rich people. I mean, they lost 95% of their money in many cases. That's what the stock market did. So that there was buyer's remorse.
Okay, so hopefully I'm hearing this correctly. You're saying that though there was inflation that cut their fortunes in half as well. Did I hear that correctly?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, sure. You know, well, Brian, that is something I don't think that a lot of people understand. I remember my father sitting me down and explaining inflation to me and how it was kind of this silent way to tax people in a way, or silent way to that where people in essence kind of lost money. And I don't think a lot of people understand that it is kind of a silent assault on your wealth creation.
Yeah, J.P. Morgan, when he died in, what, 1916, he died with an estate of $67 million. As Carnegie said, must have been 1913, Carnegie said, I never knew he was so poor. He only had $67 million. Yeah. Well, okay, that's when the price level, as we count it now, was 10. Well, it was 20. It was 22. A few years later, that means that his real fortune, his real buying, investing power was only $33.5 million. and so for his heir, for J.P. Morgan II in 1920. And, you know, that changes a lot. I mean, the second half of his fortune was probably largely dedicated to crazy entrepreneurial ventures. That's the really rich person's mad money, where you say, okay, I'm going to take a flyer on this crazy investment with this guy who keeps knocking on my door. You cut that fortune in half, you just basically eliminate what we today call venture capital.
Interesting, interesting. Okay, let's, you know what, Steve, let's go to break early so that we can come back. And you had three things in this piece: the Federal Reserve should be open to closing. And you define the Fed's business aspirations, and then you address those, Brian, in this very important piece. So let's go to break. This is Kim Munson. I'm talking with Dr. Brian Dmytrovic. He is with the... is it the Laffer Institute?
The Laffer Center for Supply Studies.
Okay, great. So let's go to break and we'll be right back.
Award-winning realtor Karen Levine has 30 years of experience with RE/MAX Alliance. As a director with the National Association of Realtors, Karen Levine works to protect private property rights. Karen Levine believes in homeownership. Because of Karen's love of dogs, Karen volunteers with GRR, Golden Retriever Rescue of the Rockies, helping golden retrievers find their forever homes. Choose Karen Levine to buy or sell your home because she understands that it's more than just a house. Karen Levine comes highly recommended by Kim Munson. Call award-winning realtor Karen Levine with RE/MAX Alliance today at 303-877-7516. That's 303-877-7516.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Check out our website, kimmunson.com. We'll have our show recaps and all the podcasts there. And you'll probably want to go back and listen to this because I have Dr. Brian Dmytrovic on the line. He's with the Laffer Center, also author of Iconoclast and JFK and the Reagan Revolution, that he wrote that book with Larry Kudlow. The Fed, particularly libertarians, have, I mean, that's one of the big issues they have is the Fed. And this piece that you had in Forbes, the Federal Reserve should be open to closing, is a very important piece. But you defined what the Fed's business aspirations were. Could you describe those for our listeners, please, Brian?
Yeah. When the Fed was founded, its first business goal was to provide a comprehensive reserve system for the major and ultimately minor banks of the United States. Okay, that was its first aspiration. Then the second one, and this came to be a big bear, was that it decided it would become the principal regulator of the banking system. So the Federal Reserve would determine whether or not your banking practices are good or bad. And then finally, and this is the one we know it for today, it decided it would become the nation's chief money issuer. Now that was completely out of nowhere and has really kind of transformed how we think about monetary creation in an unproductive way.
Mm-hmm. And so you've addressed each of these things in the piece, and I think we've talked a bit about the banking system and regulation. As we go back to the five pillars of Reaganomics, and I know I should have them to memory, and I could only think of four of them. It was lower spending, lower regulations, lower taxes, stable money, and what was the other one, Brian?
And President Trump's favorite, free trade.
Oh, and free trade, that's right. And so it seems like with the Fed, what it's trying to do is stable money, but you have the key word there, and that's regulate. And whenever you see the word regulate, that typically is another code word for force. And I know that the regulators, when they come in with a lot of these different banks, I mean, they can pick winners and losers. I mean, there's all kinds of things. And so the Fed, maybe we need to pull back on those regulations. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, the Fed has kind of ruined the regulatory environment in that before, regulation was done privately. In particular, it was done competitively. And if you take the competitive aspect out of regulation, it really renders it useless. In the major way that banks, in fact, any business really was regulated before, say, the Securities Exchange Commission in 1934, was that they paid their shareholders their quarterly profits, their half-year or yearly profits. And that if you're making up what you're doing, you will miss your dividend payment immediately, and you will be completely exposed right away as fraudulent.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've taxed dividends, and we have, in their place, put regulation. And it should be no surprise to us that this is a kind of a profound era of financial fraud, because we never have to show anyone the money.
And the regulators through the Obama administration, was it at the Dodd-Frank? You can tell me. But isn't that what it caused all these community banks to either go out of business or be absorbed by bigger banks? That's a lot of concern to me as well, Brian.
Yeah, I'm fine with calling it Dodd-Frank, because those two, really should have, Christopher Dodd and Bonnie Frank, really should have that monstrosity hung around their necks. Although, to Bonnie Frank's credit, he has withdrawn his support rhetorically for a lot of what he did as a banking regulator. And I have to say, that is to his credit. That bill really should have called the Large and Unproductive, Uncompetitive Big Banks Protection Act.
That pretty well names it, Brian Dmytrovic. So let's continue on here with this piece that you had written, and that is the money creation. That is something that really concerns people, is the Fed creating money.
Yeah, this aspect of American history is so lost, and it's funny to talk about all this new education, 1619 Project, New York Times, where you do about American history. Boy, it's something lost in American history. Is that the government really didn't create any money for ages until 1913. What the United States did was define what this thing called a dollar is. What is a dollar? It is a ratio of 15.5 silvers to one gold, or gold to 20 to 67 an ounce. And what that meant is that any private person or private institution, namely a bank, could issue a piece of paper saying this is a dollar as defined by the United States government. And therefore, you are legally entitled to whatever the government says it is, which is an ounce of gold for 20 of these. And so virtually all monetary creation was private outside of times of war and their aftermath in the 19th century.
And okay, so that brings up the conversation about gold standard. And that goes over to, I think, one of your five pillars, and that is stable money. So how do we get to that today now?
Yeah, so in the 19th century, prices didn't move at all as we reconstruct these price levels. I mean, it was utterly stable, again, outside of the times the United States really printed money in war. And we had historic rates of growth. I mean, sometimes 1870s, 1880s, we had 6.5% per annum rates of growth for 20 years. And this is after the country had been growing 4% for 75 years. So what's not to like about this kind of economy? When you have stable money, then you have people who use the money not for hedging, not for financial speculation, not for guessing where the dollar is going to be in the future, but for real economic enterprises. And I think that has so much to do with any sluggishness we see in the economy today.
Well, and it seems to me that back in Washington, that they are trying to do everything they can to get this economy slowed down. You know, Trump comes in. Well, Obama had said, the 1 to 1.5% GDP growth, this is the new normal. And what's Trump going to do? Wave a magic wand? Well, he comes in, and the magic wand, I mean, we were bumping up around 3.5% until the PBIs, the politicians, bureaucrats, and interested parties realized that, oh, my gosh, if we actually have a guy coming in that does, has results for everyday American workers, then maybe we might lose our elections. And so I think they're trying to get it slowed down. But it has been amazing what happened.
Yeah, I'm really happy that we're bumping up against 3% growth. It's really unusual in a really long economic cycle. So we've had this so-called Obama boom at being 1.8%. And then Trump kicked it up and off basically by a full percent. And then the thing Arthur Laffer always says is that, and then in comparison to the rest of the world, there's such a huge differential now to how the United States is growing. So we have to be pretty satisfied with this economy, and there's no reason whatsoever not to keep it going.
Okay. And on that note, there's a question I want to ask you. And we've talked about this in the past, that you think that we really get this economy rolling, that we can actually grow our way out of some of these issues that we're facing, such as Social Security, But student loan debt, this is the thing that you are seeing the politicians are wanting to address it out here in Colorado. There is a piece of legislation that's being proposed that if somebody has lived in Colorado for at least 12 months, that then the state of Colorado will pay for their first 2 years of college loans, if you can believe that. But I think that there's this concern. These young people are like, how will I ever pay this off? Does government need to be taking from one person to give to another to pay off their student loans, or can we grow our way out of this?
The first thing is the student loans are completely ridiculous. They are entirely a creation of the federal college financial and regulatory system. They exist because the federal government has provided loan guarantees. So in one way, I understand the responsibility implicitly the federal government is taking for these loans. I understand that. The thing is that the idea that the United States is going to pay off $850 billion or something like that, I mean, the United States fiscal is ridiculous right now. The most important thing is for the United States to grow at 3 or 4 or 5% per year. If it does, there will be no problems in Social Security, health care, financial future, student loans, because that pays for everything.
Okay. The other thing I was kind of floating around in my brain is that colleges, you know, they don't have to deliver a product that the person gets out and makes sure that they have a job and that they're productive. You know, they just are in the business of, you know, getting these degrees out to people, and then good luck to you, and happy to have these kids take these student loans on. Maybe we should start to have some of these college endowments pay for some of these student loans, and maybe then we'd start to have a more competitive environment and better results. What's your thoughts on that, Brian?
Well, Kim, the funny thing is the colleges with the really huge endowment, and, you know, we're talking like Princeton, they actually pay for their students quite well. I mean, you have to earn a lot of money to pay any tuition at all at Princeton. So they're doing that already. They're just not publicizing it. The places that really kill us with student loans are these smaller schools, and in particular state schools, that are overregulated and then just collect tuition. If we have large endowments, like in the old days, like in 1913 when tuition was $200 a semester or a year, you will see that there are no student loans and that everything is driven by endowments. So when we say we want to tax the wealthy, you can forget about having college endowments and you better say hello to student loans.
Okay, fascinating. And then Social Security. You know, I get, and it's gone around the internet quite a bit, and it's like, hey, you know, us boomers, we paid into Social Security, and now they say that there's not enough money, that the Social Security Trust Fund or whatever it was has been raided, and we paid that money in, and so we are due that. And I always kind of have to push back just a little bit. I'm like, under our watch, we let this happen. And so why do we think that the next generation has to pay for our mistake? I feel like that's a bit immoral. What would your comment be on that, Brian?
Yeah, of course, Social Security is a misrepresentation. It is, for all intents and purposes, a Ponzi scheme. That's what it is. In fact, it's explicit about that. It uses current contributions to pay for its past promises. That is actually, by definition, what a Ponzi scheme is. So there's no reason for us to believe that there is a pot of money that has been saved from the past. It is, in fact, impossible for the government to save money, in that what would it do with it? It would have to put it in the banking system, and what is the banking system? You know, regulated by the government, so guaranteed by the government. The only solution to the Social Security crisis is economic growth. If there's 5% economic growth for the long term, then in the future, we, number one, will have enough contributions for the Social Security Trust Fund, and number two, nobody will need them because they're so prosperous. So again, it's impossible to get out of the Social Security trap without economic growth.
But what I'm hearing, Brian, we're just about out of time, is there is hope. If we can actually, we can address these problems, because I think a lot of people throw up their hands and say, you know, this is what it is. You're saying there is hope. We can actually address these problems as with the American Prosperity and Idea.
Oh,
if the United States grows at over 3%, say, 3.5, 4, whatever, even, some kind of historical good rate of growth, these problems will completely evaporate. We saw this in the late 1990s. I mean, all of a sudden, is your budget deficit scaremongering is going to be there for our grandchildren? Gone. Because there was significant economic growth, especially after that capital gains tax rate cut in 1997. So, if we get into gear in the 2020s at 3.5, 4% growth, we will not be talking about these problems anymore.
Oh, man. I tell you what, I'm feeling really positive, Dr. Brian Dimitrovic. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And our quote for today, I chose this. It's a JFK quote, and I thought that you might like this. So let's see. He said, "I see no magic in tax dollars which are sent to Washington and then returned. I abhor the waste and incompetence of large-scale federal bureaucracies in this administration as well as in others. I do not favor state compulsion when voluntary individual effort can do the job and do it well." And so I thought you might like that quote, Brian Dimitrovic.
Here's to JFK.
Most definitely. And be sure and pick up that book. That is JFK and the Reagan Revolution. That's written by Dr. Brian Dimitrovic and Larry Kudlow. Brian, thank you so much, and we will talk to you soon.
Okay, great, Kim. Bye.
Yeah, keep up the good work. And so today, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. This is Kim Munson signing off. God bless you, and God bless America. Young, like a